My name is John Osgood, and we're going to have a look at the moment at an in-depth and in-length look at the history of mankind since the flood. Now, you've just seen a film about the flood, and of course, normal secular history would like to eliminate the fact of the flood because it just doesn't fit in and it just doesn't agree with many of the suppositions. Biblical history is very clear. There's been approximately 2,300 years BC that the flood occurred, and there's been 2,000 years since, so approximately 4,300 years since the flood. Now, the Bible is quite specific on the dating of this particular event. Now, if we look at the general recognised, shall we say, anthropological history of mankind, we see the following things. We see it divided up into two basic periods: the historical period in which we live, and the prehistorical period, which again is divided up into three groups, starting with the Stone Age, the Bronze Age, the Iron Age, each of them with their own classifications. In the Stone Age we have the Paleolithic or the Old Stone Age, then we have the Mesolithic or the Middle Stone Age, the Neolithic or the New Stone Age. Now, these ages are generally classified around cultures, and the cultures are to a large extent surrounding the instruments of those cultures, the knives and the axes and so on that these cultures had. The only problem with this, of course, is that these are not adequate means of dating anything. As you will probably realise, the Australian Aborigines existing today are a so-called Stone Age people because they are using the instruments of the Stone Age, but we happen to know that they are living in the 20th century. Therefore, the same instruments that they use today and these men lived used supposedly 10,000 years ago don't really give us a clue as to when they lived. Now then we come to the Bronze Age because of the use of bronze as the main metal of warfare and instrumentation, and then the Iron Age, and some of the bronze in the Iron Age of course brings us into the early historical period in some areas of the earth, but not in all. Now that's the generally broad recognised division of history as we know it. The Bible, on the other hand, gives us a view that man has lived upon this earth for approximately 6,000 years. The first 1,500 of those years, there was a longevity. And if we are to take the biblical record as an average, that the average population, the average lifespan was over 900 years. Following the flood, we are shown that the ages decreased very rapidly. Something happened at the flood that caused the decrease of longevity. And if you plot the few figures that are available from the Bible, you'll find that it falls in the manner of this graph here. And if you look at the idealized curve I put beside it, you'll see that it generally falls as an exponential curve or a random decay curve after some catastrophe, single catastrophe, has hit the population, eventually coming down to 70 years, which is the biblical duration of man today. Now, what we are told about the Bible by secular historians who wish to not accept it as a documentary record of a history, and I make it clear that as I speak here, I take it as a good documentary record of history. In fact, as you'll see as we go on, I take it as the most reliable backbone to the historical record. Now, let's have a look at the supposed idea that the Bible came down to us by many, many generations handed down by word of mouth over countless generations, which is one of the suppositions, and not always a supposition, as stated facts, so many people believe. Now, if we graph the ages of the patriarchs mentioned in the book of Genesis side by side after the flood, we find that there is, in accordance with that curve, a decrease of the lifespan. But if we graph the first 10 generations, we find the following thing. First of all, we see Noah living for 350 years. If we go down with all the figures given to us, we find that 292 years after the flood was the birth of Abraham. Noah lived for 350 years. Therefore, Noah and Abraham were contemporary for approximately 63 years, if my arithmetic is correct. In other words, this oral tradition was not handed down necessarily by word of mouth over countless generations, but from over 10 generations by the original man who came through the flood. Secondly, we have a look at Shem, who lived 600 years altogether and 502 of those after the flood. And we find that not only was he contemporary with Abraham when after Abraham was born, but if you'll notice on this, he actually outlived Abraham. So when Abraham was dead and Isaac was alive, Shem was still living. Now Shem went through the flood. So the Bible tells us. Shem and Abraham could converse mouth to mouth about the record. The Bible eliminates countless generations. Now Abraham, we are told, came out of Ur of the Chaldees. And it is likely that he did in fact speak to Shem, although there is no record necessarily that we can put our fingers upon to be certain of that particular fact. Certainly the events could be known very clearly from the then long living Shem. Now, the Bible tells us that the flood was universal and that the whole earth was destroyed except for 8 people: Noah, his wife, his 3 sons, Japheth and his wife, Shem, his wife, and Ham, his wife. So the implications are that the whole earth has come from these 3 men. Now, if we have a look at some of the legends extant upon the face of the earth now, we look at the Indian legend, which comes down to us from the Sanskrit, from the Aryan invaders. And we find that there was a man who is called in the Indian language Satyarata, and he had 3 sons: Ayyapeti, looks terribly like Japheth; Sharma, not unlike Shem; and Kahama, not unlike Ham. If we go to the Chinese legends, we find that there were 3 sovereigns. I'm not sure if the Chinese actually viewed them as contemporary or whether they viewed them as one after the other. But in any case, if you look at them, there's Hu Tsai, Shen Nung, and Huang Ti. Now, it's a fairly difficult process transliterating names from the Hebrew across to the Chinese, but let's look at the characteristics. If you look at the record of the scripture, and we will see this a little bit later, you'll see that Japheth and his progeny, you realise the outcome of those people the Bible infers, then they had a very big cultural and philosophic heritage. Shem, on the other hand, has a very big religious overtones, or shall we say spiritual overtones. Ham, on the other hand, very much associated with the most basic technology on the face of the earth. And there is these 3 big emphases from the nations that arose from these men. Now let's have a look at them in the Chinese history. Fu Tsai, who I'm here going to suggest could well be Japheth, inventor of the arts and crafts in the Chinese legend. Shen Nung, whom I am going to suggest the possibility, and I can take it no further than that, that may well be a Chinese remembrance of Shem, was known as the divine cultivator. And Huang Ti, who I'm going to suggest also, is the Chinese remembrance of Ham, known as the Yellow Emperor, was supposedly the father of the Chinese people historically. Now, we'll come a little bit later back to Huang Ti and his son Chuan Si, but I just want you to notice the names of these 2 men in the Chinese legend. If you look at the Hebrew record, you'll find that Ham had a son called Canaan. We'll look at him later. And you'll notice that Huang Ti, the Yellow Emperor, had a son from whom the Chinese count descent, called Chuan Si. I believe it is possible to find the word Canaan in there, and I suggest the possibility of the Canaan of the Hebrew and the Qiansu of the Chinese being possibly the same person, but I can take it no more than suggestion at this stage. The Greeks also had legend. There are many other legends, but these are just the leading ones. The Greeks, according to the Hebrew legend, came from Japheth. They were the Javan and his sons. The Greeks look back to one man called Japetos. It doesn't come out quite as simple a legend as the Bible, but nonetheless, Japetos, which is not terribly far removed from the name Japheth or Ayapeti of the Indian. Now, there is in Genesis chapter 10 and following on in Genesis chapter 9 some bold statements there. There is in Genesis chapter 10 a document known as the Table of the Nations. It's a unique document. Nowhere on the face of the earth is there to be found a document that deals with the races of mankind in such detail. Many, of course, have suggested that it's just myth, but let's have a look at it in detail and find out whether in fact it is myth or whether it goes further than that and has a very real basis of fact. According to the Table of the Nations, there was Japheth, who had 7 sons, Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tyrus. And from Gomer we get Ashkenaz, Riphaz, and Togarmah. From Javan, Elisha, Tarshish, Kittim, and Rodanim. From Shem we have 5, Elam, Asher, Arphaxad, Lud, and Aram, and numerous sons from some of these. Then from Ham we have 4 sons basically, Cush, Mizraim, Put, and Canaan. Now the Bible itself explains who these people were, some of these people were, and explains what happened to their descendants. Some of them are not mentioned any further, and we'll have to look at historical records and see if we can throw a bit of light onto it. But the implication of the Table of Nations and the other statements of the scripture are the following. Among many that can be deduced are the following. There was the total annihilation of mankind at the flood, approximately 2300 BC, except for Noah and his family, 8 people. There is secondly a total world population now traceable back to 3 sons of Noah in accordance with the biblical directives. That's the implication. If the whole earth was destroyed, then the whole present earth must descend from Noah. So not only according to the scriptures do we trace our descent back to Adam, but we trace it directly, every one of us, back to Noah. The third, language confusion, which the Bible suggests, it doesn't give an actual date, but other things thrown together suggest the possibility of 2200 BC approximately, with broad groups of languages probably able to be related to 3 families. That's the suggestion implied. Some might say, no, I'm reading too much into it, but we'll have a look at the languages later and see that there is in fact some basis to this. And 4, that all history is able to be fitted around the backbone of biblical chronology. Now let's have a look at these 3 people. Now in Genesis chapter 9, we see a little event there where Noah, a bit indiscreet, grew a vineyard, got himself drunk on one occasion. A certain event occurred which brought shame on Noah from his youngest son Ham. The result was that Noah cursed not Ham, but Ham's son. The reason for that, of course, is you don't curse your son, that reflects on you. You curse his son, that reflects on him. And I believe that to be one of the reasons for it, as well as the foresight of Almighty God in the distribution of the races. But Noah states certain things there. He says, "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be to his brethren." Now he picks on Canaan, one of the sons of Ham, and not on all the sons of Ham. Why? We don't know.
But certainly in the foresight of God we'll see one of the possible reasons for it. Now the implications of that are that Canaan would be dominated, the descendants of Canaan would be dominated by the other races of the world. He would be a servant in some manner or other. And in Genesis 10 we're told, after the sons of Canaan were born, that afterwards were the families of the Canaanites spread abroad. In other words, there is a special directive applied to this man above all the other people mentioned in the table of the nations, to the effect that this man and his descendants would be scattered across the face of the earth. More than the other is implied by the silence of the others. Now, the resulting conclusions or expectations, if one reads these conclusions into it, are that there would be a large distribution, a large confusion, a large dispersion, particularly of the Canaanites, but of the sons of Ham. And the history of the Canaanites and the descendants, and possibly of the Hamites by implication, would be that of being dominated by other races. Blessed be the Lord God of Shem, Noah said of Shem. This implies a closeness of Shem with God. It implies, because this was put in a prophetical sense, that there would be a close spiritual relationship with the descendants of Shem. And the implications of all that is said about Shem is that there would possibly be a confined distribution, not so much of a scattering, but a heavy spiritual influence coming from the sons of Shem. Japheth, Noah said, God shall enlarge Japheth. And in Genesis 10, by these were the isles of the nations divided. Also, when he said, God shall enlarge Japheth, he said, and he shall dwell in the tents of Shem, indicating that at some stage in history, Japheth would pick up the gauntlet of Shem and transmit it further, in whatever that Hebrew language implies. So, with Japheth, we would expect a large distribution, but not such a great dispersion and a scattering. In other words, in a reasonably united body, with not so great amount of confusion as occurred to the Hamites. Let's see if history bears this out. There's the table of the nations again. Now let's look at the sons of Japheth. First we'll come to Gomer. There are four people mentioned here: Gomer, Ashkenaz, Riphath, and Togarmah. Now there's a map of the world. And I have the four sons listed. Excuse me. I have the four sons of the three sons of Gomer and Gomer himself there, listed in the various colours. And you'll notice that with Gomer I've got a broad distribution around between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea, and spreading out across Europe towards France, Spain, Britain, and a small touching in Eastern America. The latter comes from only recent discoveries in Northern and Eastern America. Now Gomer, when seen against an historical background, we find the following facts seem to emerge. First of all, the Hebrews recognized Gomer as living up initially in the early days up between the Black and the Caspian Sea and round the Black Sea. There is a name given to the district, Simra, by language transliteration. It can be shown that this is not difficult to bring this back to the basic word Goma. We get the word Crimea from that. A region called the Crimea, which I believe looks back to Goma. In the times of Homer, there were a group called the Kimmerer. Again, by transliteration, it is not difficult to get it from the word Goma. They occupied Asia Minor here, and they spread up this way towards the west. The Armenians referred to Cappadocia as Gamia, G-A-M-I-R, and it's not difficult to see the word Goma in this. Eusebius actually quotes the Cappadocians with Goma. Now, the history, the ancient records suggest that these Gomerites spread up to the west into France, Spain, eventually as the Celts, to England, Ireland, and a small touch in the deep in the past across to Eastern America. Now, there was a branch, this branch in Asia Minor came to be called the Galatians. And again, I'm assured that ethnologists can still get the word Galatia from the word Goma by transliteration. I'm not an ethnologist nor a linguist, but I'm assured that this is not stretching the imagination too far. And in Asia Minor, or the ancient Hittite areas, there was a town called Tip Gawar. I think that might be the pronunciation. And it is easily deducible from the word Goma. And so the city, one of the ancient cities of the Hittites, was traceable to this name. We come to words like Gaul. To Galati, the Galatians. And I am told even by the Celtic name, the Celts, by simple transliteration of the languages along the route, can in fact be deduced from the word Goma. So the historical record, as well as the inferences of the Bible, because Goma is mentioned again in later years in the Bible, and it is inferred that he came from the north, or that he went to the north. But the historical record suggests that these people multiplied to the west and occupied the areas of Spain, upper northern Spain, France, England, a little bit up towards Denmark, and they would probably historically be what archaeologists know as the Beaker people. Now, as well as that, associated with him were these other three sons, Togarmah, Eurythaz, and Ashkenaz. Now, Riphath. Up here, above the Caspian Sea, there is a range of mountains known as the Urals. One of the early names for the Urals was the Riphath Mountains. And the peoples that dwelt in this area were called the Riphath. I don't think it's hard to see a resemblance of the names there. There was a people called the Ribii, which many believe can be traced to them, in the area of the Black Sea, and another group of people, Riphu, east of the Black Sea, up in this area. The word Carpathian is thought originally to come from the word Riphath. And there is the suggestion, though it would be a hard task proving it, of the legend of Europus, the name Europus, in other words, the name Europe, possibly originally coming from the name Riphath. Now, Togarmah. Now, the suggestion is that Riphath also spread over into Europe. The exact distribution can't be ascertained for certain, but the impression gained is that a large portion of Europe has origins to be traced back to this man, one of the sons of Goma. Togarmah, Ezekiel, he's looked on as coming from the north parts, and that again refers to this region. an Armenian tradition, they had an ancestor called Hayak, who was the son of Targum. Not difficult to see that from the word Togomar. The Armenians were referred in ancient times as the House of Targum, and some believe the name Turk to actually come from the root Togomar. The Phrygians, or the Phrygians as they were called originally, up in this area here. Where are we? Not sure that my map is absolutely accurate. But again, up in that area in early times and spreading over towards the west, Phrygians, the word Phrygian was thought also to come from the word Togomar. And many believe that the strong indication is that the word Germany has come not from Goma, but from Togomar. I leave with that. Now, Ashkenaz, that name is used even today, the so-called Ashkenazi Jews, certain Jews that came from certain parts of Europe back to the Promised Land, referred to as Ashkenazi Jews. Now, Ashkenaz here is in red. Again, he was recognized by the Hebrews as living up in this Black Sea, Caspian Sea area. There is a group that has gone east, or that went east of the Caspian Sea on ancient maps, called Ashkenoi. The word has also been traceable in tribes that migrated west, and from which we get our words Scandinavia and Saxon. Both of them can easily be derived from the word Ashkenazi, and the suggestion of the culture and the history of these people suggests that they also migrated to the west and took up an area north of Goma, up in the Scandinavian region. There's a number of lakes called Ashkenia in Bithynia, and the name is found along the route, particularly around the Black Caspian Sea. Now let's move on to some of the other sons of Japheth. We come to Madai, Javam, and his sons, Elisha, Tarshish, Kittim, Dodanim, or Rodanim. There's no difficulty with the major situation with Madai. The Madai are the Medes, but they embrace more than the Medes. They actually embrace the Aryan groups that eventually descended down into India onto the native black population of India, and the Medes that descended down into Persia and influenced the Persian peoples there. On the Persian monuments, the Medes are referred to as Madai, M-A-D-A. The Mede word is a Greek word, of course. In Assyrian monuments, they are referred to as Ma-da-ai, which is clearly derivable from Madai. The word Aryan or Arius, or Yavanus, as it is transliterated, can also be derived from this other son, Javan. We'll come to him in a moment. But the Medes and the Aryans can be traced over here, east and south of the Caspian Sea. Now let's look at Javan. Javan in the Hebrew is the word for Greece. It's used constantly as the word for Greece, and it's found in a number of places. Egyptian inscription infers that the people who dwelt around the northern parts of the Mediterranean, or surrounded the great circle of the Mediterranean, were a people. It's written something like this, U-I-N-I-V-U, which many trace back to the word Javan. The Persians called the Greeks the Eunuch, which also can be derived from. Now let's look at Javan's sons. Before I do, I just mention that Javam also gives rise to the word Ionian. And the Ionian peoples affected Greece particularly and also Italy. Elisha, his son, many derive the word Hellas, which is another name for Greece. And there was a people called the Aelians, which can be derived straight back to Elisha, and they lived in Asia Minor here. Tarshish, the next son of Javam, all we know is that the Bible infers that they were a people living, a great seafaring people living towards the end of the Mediterranean Sea. In Spain there was a city and a culture called Tartessos, and I don't think it's hard to get the word Tartessos from Tarshish by any simple rules. Let's look at Kittim. Kittim is the Hebrew name for Cyprus. The Greeks called Cyprus Kition, and the peoples as Kittians. Some of mainland Greece here received the name as well, the people of Kittim. There's been a suggestion made, which looks a reasonable one to look at, that if you put the root Ma, which means land, in a number of Indo-European languages, Ma and Kittim together, and change it to the soft Greek CH Marchitum, very soon you come down to a word Macedon, Macedonia, from which Philip and Alexander arose. And that's in Greece, which is not out of keeping with the distribution of these people historically. Dodanum, or Rodanum as it is in the scripture alternatively, seem again to be a peoples associated with the Greek area. Many believe the island of Rhodes comes from the name. Some would argue that the river Rhone, along further, comes from the name. And there is an argument that the word Dardanelles comes, in fact, from the word Dodanum. Dardanelles, of course, are up here. It's not unreasonable. It's in the area of their supposed distribution. Look at it a little bit further. The sons of Japheth. And we come to Magog, Meshech, Tubal, and Tyrus. You'll forgive me for a little bit of inaccuracy with regard to my colours on the map, but the distribution historically is fairly difficult to put down exactly. Many of the documentary evidence, of course, is not available. But Magog, the word means the land of Gog. In Ezekiel they're referred as coming out of their place in the north parts. They are associated by the Hebrews to be a northern tribe of people, again beyond the Black and the Caspian Seas. The suggestion has been made that Marco Polo believed that the word Mongol, although it's applied to a different group of people originally, or Mongol as we know it today, came from the word for Magog. And even among the Mongol areas you find an Indo-European language, which is the language associated with the Japhetic races. Now, Josephus insists that Magog, his people, are associated with the Russians, the Russian peoples. And in fact, in the book of Ezekiel, is the man spoken of as the chief prince of Magog, of Meshech, Tubal, and Gog. And the word prince is head or rosh, from the Hebrew word ros or rosai, for the Russian peoples. And this leader is associated with a confederation of nations that embraces Meshech, Tubal Magog. And from these words, many get the following. Meshech, the word Moscow, or Moscow, the city of Moscow today. Tubal, an ancient city called Tobolsk, down here, in above the Caspian Sea. Many claim the Tiberiae of ancient record came from these, of people occupying this area above the Caspian Sea. In Assyrian monuments, the Meshech, people of Meshech, were called Moskai, and they're classically called Moskai. In Armenia, there is said to be a mountain chain called the Moskai Mountains, indicating that these people of Meshech at one stage lived there. The impression gained is that they eventually spread up and formed a major part of the Russian nation as we know today. Tyrus is the last of the Japhethites. Not an enormous number of things can be deduced from this, except the word Thracian seems to have an association, from which we get some of the Goths, and the impression is among the ethnologists that the Thracians, the descendants of Tyrus, gave rise to a large number of the Teutonic nations. So there we see Magog, Meshech, Tubal and Tyrus. If we put all the sons of Japheth together, we get the following picture. Superimpose the maps. And you'll see that the whole of the Indo-European speaking world is enveloped by the Japhetic peoples. A group of languages, some 300 or more, stretches from Siberian and the Indian regions right across to England, embracing most of Europe. Now that's the inferences to be drawn from history and the biblical suppositions of the sons of Japheth. Now let's look a little bit further, the sons of Shem. The sons of Shem were Elam, Asher, Arphaxad, Lud and Aram. Now it was said of the Shemites from Noah that the Lord God of Shem will be blessed, indicating a relationship between Shem, from which we get the word Semites, and a very great religious or rather spiritual significance. Now let's have a look at the nations that came from the sons of Shem. Now just appreciate that what I'm saying about nations are oversimplified facts, but what I'm giving is the backbone of history. There are many interactions between these nations, there are many invasions and disturbances of these principles, there are many intermarriages. So what we're talking about is purely the backbone of distribution of the nations that arose from these people. Elam. Elam is the word used in Hebrew for Persia. And the Elamites, who are referred to also in secular records as such, settled over here in Persia and were probably the first settlers of the land of Sumer to be driven over further into Persia or to migrate further over into Persia. The identification of the Elamites is reasonably simple as a general principle. Asher is the Hebrew word for Assyria, and the Assyrians occupied this area of upper Mesopotamia and spread out in the environs. Aram, this last one here, is the word used in the Hebrew for Syria. And you see it in red on the map in the upper part of Asia Minor, the Fertile Crescent,
The area we of course know today as Syria. From them we get the Aramaic languages. Then we have Lud in green. Josephus tells us that the Lydians up here, some degree in around the coasts of Asia Minor, came from Lud. There is very little record of that particular event. We've got to rely on historical documents like Josephus to get any verification of that. Our fact set requires a larger discussion. Josephus implies that Arphaxad gave rise to the Chaldeans. Now when we look at Arphaxad, and I'll put up again the table of the nations so you can see, there it is superimposed, you'll see that Arphaxad gave birth to, or fathered Sala, and Sala fathered Eba. Eba is the name from which the word Hebrew comes. The Hebrews were not just Israelites, they were a large group of people. Eber had a son Peleg and a son Joktan. Peleg seems to have been of great fame in those days. In his days the earth was divided, we are told. And there is a history of a group called the Pelakah, who were sons of Hebrus, and who migrated over towards Greece, and there seems to be a river called the Hebrus River over there, and many believe that the word Pelasgian and Pelagonian and Peloponnese may well come from the word Peleg. The other thing to note is, of course, the Israelite nation eventually came from the descendants of Peleg. There's Abraham mentioned there. His line is traced out. But let's look at Joktan for the moment. Joktan, the Chaldeans, is Josephus' implications of these people. Now, we're told in Scripture that they dwelt down in an area somewhere in the Arabian Peninsula, and it's defined. It's said to be from a city called Mesha. I'm not sure whether this is one, an ancient seaport called Musa on the west coast here, or whether in fact in this name we might find the origins of the word Mecca. But I'll leave it to you. I can't draw any conclusions from that. But let us look at the names of the sons of Joktan. There's Almadad. In South Arabia there is a city called Almadad. There is Shelef. In the Yemen there is Es-Sulaf. And the peoples around that area were known by Ptolemy as the Salapini. Hazarmaveth, we can find the word Hadramat, a city in the Arabian Peninsula. We come to Jerah, there is a fortress down there called Jerak. Hadoram, we come to a peoples mentioned by Pliny and Ptolemy called the Adramitae. Uzel, it's an old name for the Yemen capital down there. Dikla in the Yemen, Dakla is the name of the city, of the town. Obel, in South Arabia, there are a number of towns and districts called Abel. Abimael, we know of nothing. Sheba, it's believed from them came the Sabaeans mentioned in Scripture and in other sources. Ophah or Apha, Sabaean capital, modern day Safa or Sapphira of Ptolemy. Havilah, there is a town called Qolan. And Jobab, Ptolemy speaks of the Jobabites. Now later on there are descendants of Abraham by Ishmael that eventually became the nation we know as the Nabataeans, which also descended into the northern part of the Arabian Peninsula. But the distribution of the Chaldeans or the sons of Arphaxad through his son Joktan seemed to be the original inhabitants of the Arabian Peninsula.
So you'll see the conclusions to be drawn about the sons of Shem are that they are in a confined area in the Middle East and environs, and you'll recognise from those distributions that the Israelites eventually came there, the Arabian peoples to a large extent came from the three great languages of the book: Judaism, Christianity and Islam arose from the Semitic peoples. They have a very big spiritual influence upon the face of the earth. As well as that, as you'll see when I show the language distribution on the face of the earth, you'll see that the Arabic nation, the Arabic language rather, has spread right across North Africa. And so we would expect that the Semitic influence will spread right across North Africa in terms of language as a result of the Muslim invasions. Now we come to the more controversial one, and this is Ham, and particularly his son Canaan. Now the sons of Ham were Mizraim, Cush, Put and Canaan. Four of those words can easily be identified in the Hebrew, but the implications of the sons of Canaan cannot easily be derived, except that we're told that after Canaan had his sons, that they were then spread across the face of the earth. We see in Israel or in Palestine a group of congregating of the Canaanites, which certainly doesn't fit the definition of the Canaanites being spread across the face of the earth. So we've got to look outside the Palestinian groups to see where the distribution of the Canaanites were. But before we get to the Canaanites, let's look at Mizraim. Mizraim is the Hebrew word for Egypt. Some would even equate the first king of Egypt as Menes, M-E-N-E-S in the Greek, or in the English transliteration of the Greek. Some would even equate the very man himself with Mizraim. There will be more of that later. Mizraim is Egypt. Josephus confirms it as the Bible holds it right down through biblical documentation. Mizraim is Egypt. Now, out of Mizraim there came a number of groups. Some of them can be identified. The Kaptorums basically settled in the north of Egypt. The Pathrusians, I believe the town of Pathros has derived its name from them. But from a gentleman called Casluam, we get the name Philistim, the Philistines. And the Bible implication, in fact it's more than an implication, it's a broad statement repeated several times in scriptures: the Philistines came from the Egyptians. In fact, the Philistines spread up from Egypt to the lower part of Palestine. It is easy to see historically the possibility of the Philistines being Egyptians. Abraham, his day, the Philistines were clearly associated with the Egyptians. They were next door neighbours, and the Philistines were around in the days of Abraham. Many of the archaeologists would insist that this could not be so, because they equate the Philistines with a later group of people called the Sea Peoples, which were a group of people that spread around the eastern coast of the Mediterranean, apparently forced out of their homeland, which was most likely in the Greek area, and invaded Egypt, or attempted to invade Egypt and Palestine. Historically, these cannot be equated with the Philistines of the Bible, and are not. Philistines of the Bible, from which we get the word Palestine today, are an Egyptian group. They clearly come from Egypt, and the Bible attests this very strongly. Now, Cush. The name Cush is translated Ethiopia in your authorised version. The Cushites. There was a kingdom called Cush in secular history here, Ethiopia, or Miro, down the Miroan kingdom south of Egypt. The sons of Cush were broadly into two groups, a number of sons that apparently spread out across the African nation, the African continent, from which we get many of the black races today as a broad general principle. But there was also another gentleman called Nimrod, of which much is said not only in biblical history but also in secular history. It was probably Nimrod that was mainly responsible for the rebellion that occurred at Babel. He was responsible for much slavery and much rebellion against the basic principles handed down by the people who survived the flood. History tells us that he seems to have been executed, and it looks as though Shem himself was the executioner. But I won't stress that too much. Now, we're told Nimrod established a number of cities in the regions of Babylon, Erech, Akkad, and Calneh, and then he went up into the Assyrian region and built a number of cities in that region. That's the Cushites. Foot. The word foot is Libya, translated Libya in the Authorized Version. And the impression gained from the Bible and by ancient historians is that the Footites, so-called, inhabited northern Africa. The name Libya, however, comes from one of the sons of Egypt. Josephus tells that it was either Ludum or Luhabon that gives rise to the word Libya. They were neighbouring peoples. Apparently the name was adopted for some reason. The Libyan name comes from the Egyptians, but the Libyan peoples themselves come from Foot. Now let's have a look at the Canaanites. If you look at the table of the nations, you'll see that there are a number of Canaanites mentioned here. There was Sidon, there was Heth, Jebusite, Amorite, Girgashite, Hivite, Arkite, Sinite, Arvadite, Zemarite, and Hamathite. The ones in Palestine, we see the Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites, the Girgashites, the Hivites. Of these, we know that the Hittites founded a very great empire. The Hittite nation as such was an Indo-European speaking nation and was in fact mainly an Indo-European peoples who invaded from the north and adopted the ancient Hittite name and some of the culture. So when we look at the Hittites of Asia Minor, we're looking at a combined group of people coming from Heth and also from the Japhethites. The Jebusites we see in the Bible. The Amorites became of such major importance that they were able to conquer the regions of Babylon, and there was a very great empire in earlier days from the Amorites. The Girgashites, the Hivites, we meet in a small way in the Bible. But the other ones are not mentioned again. Now we come down the name to the Sinite. And the impression is gained from the Bible and also from ancient documents that there was a patriarch called Sin. His name is recorded many places in the Sinai. It's recorded in ancient Sumeria. In the Bible is called Shinar, and the word itself may in fact go back to the patriarch Sin or the Sinites. And with the Sinites, or with Patriarch Sin, we see his name transmitted down through a number of the kings of ancient Ur. We see his name in their names. Now, the other suggestion has been made that the word Sinum, later used in Isaiah, and almost certainly speaking of the Chinese people, may well go back to the man Sin, and thus to Canaan. Now I mentioned to you the documentation or the ancient record of the Chinese that they had a man called Chuan Si, which I have suggested was in fact Canaan. His father, Huang Ti, who I have suggested, was Ham. And the patriarch Sin, from which the word China eventually comes. Now, what can we back up to suggest the possibility, and it is only a possibility? Well, several things. The Canaanites were a blackish people, the record tells us. So were the Sumerians or the Shinites. They were a black-headed people, we're told. So were the Indus Valley civilization. They were called the Black Ones. The Chinese, of course, themselves are not a white colour. They themselves have quite a deal of pigment in them. Now, as well as that, as well as the colour of their race, the suggestion of the colour, with variation over the centuries, we find at least one great custom that was used in three groups. I only know of three groups in the ancient world. Among the Egyptians, who were Hamites, Mizraim. Among the people of China, or the Sumerians. And among the Chinese is the custom, when the king dies, of burying all his servants with them in the first dynasties of each of these civilizations. I don't know of it being anywhere else. There could be records elsewhere. But these three groups of people separated widely, Egypt, the Sumerians, and the Chinese, each in their first dynasties buried their servants alive with them, or slew them and buried them with the dying, with the dead king. Just a few things from culture that suggest that there is a possible link between the Canaanites, namely the Sinites, and the Chinese, the early Chinese. They appeared in western China over the mountains of Tsin, which again speaks of the patriarch Sin. Now, I'm therefore suggesting the possibility of the Chinese and the Sumerians of being of Canaanite origin. If we're suggesting that, we're also suggesting the Indians of the Americas, largely of the same origin, because it seems to be agreed that they crossed the Bering Strait and migrated downwards. What other peoples can be suggested? I want to point out it can't be proved, but there is heavy suggestion of many of these people. In this case, I want to look at the peoples of the Indus Valley civilization. They were a dark people. They were later invaded by the Japhetic Aryans, a fair people, and from these, ultimately, the caste system of India originated. Any possible clue from where they might have come? Only a small one. They obviously seem to be related to the Sumerians because of trade between them and a similar skin colour. There was a close trade association from Sumer down through Dilmun, which is centred on the island of Bahrain, along the Persian Gulf to the Indus Valley civilization. But it's interesting to note that the ancient name for the Himalayan mountains was Himavat. And I suggest the possibility can go no further than that of the relationship with one of the other sons of Canaan, the Hamathite. I can take it no further than that. There are a number of cities in the Middle East called Hamath, almost certainly going back to this man. But I suggest the possibility that the Himavat, or the Himalayan mountains, may well derive their name originally from this man. If that's the case, then we see a picture emerging like this. Mizraim, Egypt there, Phut, northern Africa, the Kushites occupying Africa, and we see the Canaanites, as well as being a small group in Palestine and founding the Hittite groups in Asia Minor, we see the Canaanites spreading out and being a force, forced by divine action, following Noah's words to open up the whole of the known world, of the unknown world, for the rest of mankind, and later being dominated by particularly the Japhetic group of nations. Now, if we put them all together, we find that it's quite reasonable to account for all the sons of Noah occupying the whole of the known world. It's a bit stuff. We've got the Americas occupied, we've got China, Australia, because the Australian Aborigines now agreed to have come down the Malayan Peninsula. The South Sea Islanders themselves came again along the similar route and spread out from the west, not from the east, as at least one archaeologist has at least proposed. Now, the sum of this is that we put the three groups in three different colours, we find that the Japhetics or the Indo-European peoples occupied the whole of Europe, crossed to Siberia, all of Russia, to England, a little smattering in North America in early times, perhaps up to Greenland, and then finally in our modern days occupying the whole of the Western world. God shall enlarge Japheth and he shall dwell in the tents of Shem. Very great enlarging of this peoples. We see the Shemites or the Semites mainly in the Middle East and giving a very great contribution to the great monotheistic religions of the world, and it seems to fit very much with the biblical prophecy. And we see the rest of the world being opened up by the Hamites, and particularly it's inferred, though I can't prove it, that the Canaanites were the largest group and multiplied to a very great amount. And their basic technology has not, in its essence, has not been really improved on by modern man. Everything that was needful for their survival, they pioneered. I refer you to Custance's book, Noah's Three Sons, if you want to follow this subject up. It goes into a very great depth, and some very brilliant recording is put in that book. Now, the last thing left in this particular topic, spread of the races, is the language distribution. And we see the following language groups. There's a large family of Indo-European languages which are clearly related, some 300 or more. Then there's a Hamito-Semitic group of nations, of languages, which again are clearly related. And then we see a number of diverse languages which cannot be related to the other two groups. The African, the Australian, the American Indian, the Dravidian, the Altaic, the Sino-Tibetan, Australo-Asiatic, Australonesian, Finnic and Uralic. Now if we map them out, you'll notice that the Indo-European groups follow the distribution to a large extent of the Japhetic peoples and their invasions, and you'll see the final taking of these languages to the Americas, to Australia and New Zealand, and Southern Africa. The Hamito-Semitic groups, you'll see, again follow the distribution of the sons of Shem, with that added fact that the language is spread via the Arab conquests right across Northern Africa. And the others can be followed along the suggested areas where the sons of Ham went, with the ones in the Arabian groups being eliminated by the Arabian language. If we put that on top of the general view of biblical history of the nations, you'll find that there is a close correlation between them. Now that's as the Bible suggests the history in breadth, the origin of the races. But still we come to the nutty problem: how long have these races been around? And so we've got to look at it in depth. Now, the Bible is quite clear in its chronology. From the flood to Abraham is 292 years, according to the Bible. From Abraham, from his birth, to Israel entering Egypt is 290 years. If we then go from the time that Abraham was given to the promise to the time Israel leaves Egypt, we find there is 430 years. From the time of the leaving of Egypt, the Exodus, to the time of Solomon's temple being built is 480 years. And the scripture is clear on these timings. Now we now can clearly identify the year, or at least with plus or minus 1 year, in which Solomon's temple was built. If you have any doubts about this, I refer you to a book called The Mysterious Numbers of the Hebrew Kings by Edward Thiel, and its primer, A Chronology of the Hebrew Kings, in which any doubt that might be in your mind will be removed very quickly, as it's clearly calculated the time that Solomon laid the temple. We can therefore calculate back. It was 967 BC. We can calculate back to the Exodus, 1445 to 1447. The former date is taken by some, the latter is taken by others, but it's only 2 years difference. We can then go back to the flood, and we come to I think it's 2242 BC. Now, the key to understanding the history of the world in terms of length of time lies with two nations, with the nation of Israel through the biblical record, and secondly with the nation of Egypt, which has the best chronology developed right back to its early beginnings. Now, if we look at the history of Egypt, we find this. We find that they have calculated that approximately 3100 BC ancient Egypt arose. Now you'll clearly see that figure is in contradiction to the figure we have arrived at for the time of the flood, 2242 BC. And the accepted chronology of Egypt goes like this: dynasties 1, 2, 3, 4 and so on, right down to 30 and further. In other words, what they are saying is they get the documents of the dynasties of the kings of Egypt, they label them according to the principles available, they then allow one dynasty to follow another, and they work out their chronology by a summation of all those dynasties and all the years put together, and they come to a varying figure, of which 3,100 is about the average. Some go to 3,400, and then they assume a large pre-dynastic period before that. Now, there are difficulties with this particular chronology of Egypt. Firstly, because Egypt was not just one nation, it was two nations. Israel itself had difficulty holding its small nation together. Egypt was a much larger nation, reaching for a very large area down the Nile Valley, or up the Nile Valley as it should be. And it is hard to imagine Egypt always being a unified nation. In fact, the suggestion and the implication of the history of Egypt is that it was two nations that at times was united under kings, sometimes from the north and sometimes from the south. In other words, I'm making the suggestion, which has been made, and not only made, but verified by Corville in his book, The Exodus Problem and Its Ramifications, that many of these dynasties did not run in sequence, they ran parallel. Now, if we come to the Bible, we find that the best period to look at to see if we can correlate the Bible and Egyptian history and work back from there is the period of the Exodus and, of course, the entry of Israel into the land. Now, when you look at the biblical record, which is very clear, you find a number of things become apparent. Firstly, the dynasty that ruled Egypt in the times of Joseph through to the Exodus had to be a stable, dominant dynasty. Secondly, the capital had to be in the north of Egypt, because many of the capitals were way down in the south. Thirdly, there was a famine of a plurality of years, which, if the Bible is to be taken literally, affected the whole earth. And if it affected Egypt, It affected the whole of Africa because of the headwaters of the Nile. If it affected the whole of Canaan and the Fertile Crescent, it therefore affected the whole of the Tigris-Euphrates system. It was, in fact, if the Bible is to be taken correctly, it was a famine that affected the whole earth. Corville has put it that whatever happened after the famine, the earth emerged quite different than it was before. So there had to be a famine of a plurality of years. Fourthly, there had to be a prime minister, or a vizier as he was called, at the time of the famine, of supreme power, next to Pharaoh only, namely Joseph. We have to find such a vizier in Egyptian history if we are to verify Joseph in that sense. There had to be a period of at least 80 years of benevolent rule over Israel by Egypt while Joseph was alive, because there is no indication in the Bible that he was removed from power. In fact, the Egyptians themselves helped the Israelites in firstly the burying of Jacob, and also there seems to be benevolence displayed all through the life of Joseph. But the Bible says that then arose a king that knew not Joseph. If he knew not Joseph, then Joseph surely had to be dead. So there would have to be, following that, a period of slave labour where they had to build cities in the north, in the Delta region. Those cities are mentioned in the Bible, Pithom and Ramesses. Now, those names indicate that there has to be evidence of use of the name Ramesses in Egyptian history by this time. There had to be a period of short, terrible natural catastrophes. There had to be a sudden destruction of Egypt, militarily, socially, and economically. In other words, Egypt would now lie entirely at the mercy of any invader. Its army would have perished in the Red Sea, and Pharaoh himself would have perished in the Red Sea, because that's what the Bible says. Socially, they would have been destroyed, for 2 million slaves would have left Egypt. Economically, they would have been destroyed because of the catastrophes of the plagues, and they would have been left without food for at least some months. There had to be the disappearance of the Pharaoh at the time, and no evidence of his grave. There had to be a sudden eclipse of Egyptian power for a period of 400 years, because it's 400 years that the biblical record starts to show the rise again of Egyptian power. There had to be a period datable from 1660 to 1440 BC. Now, those are fairly stiff conditions to look for. Just one of them will eliminate most of the dynasties of Egypt. This one, a famine of a plurality of years, because famines that last for a plurality of years in Egypt are extremely rare. And prior to recent discovery, there was only one ever recorded, and that was in the Bible. However, there have been others that have since been found and dated. Now let's have a look at the candidates, the dynastic candidates for this particular period. If we're going to claim that the Bible is an accurate document, then that is what we have to look for. That's the minimum. Let's have a look at the dynasties. Here we have early dynastic period, an old kingdom, and then an intermediate period and the temporary eclipse of Egyptian power for a short period. Then we get the middle kingdom and another eclipse of Egyptian power for a similar period. Then the new kingdom arises in the late dynastic period. Now, the candidates here are for the dynasty that ruled in the days of Joseph and the Exodus are the following. The last couple of dynasties of the old kingdom, dynasties 5 and 6. The last couple of dynasties in the middle dynasties 12 and, by inference, 13, which Corville takes out of the category of belonging to the intermediate period. Some would suggest one of these intermediate periods themselves are candidates, although they don't really fulfill the conditions. And many archaeologists would insist that the new kingdom, which embraces the great and mighty 18th dynasty,
and the 19th dynasty should be a candidate.
Well, they are the candidates for this. But let's eliminate what we can. First of all the conditions met with in the biblical account of the Exodus cannot be equated with anything in that 18th dynasty. Ramesses II has been picked out because of his name to a large extent and because of his building program as the Pharaoh of the Exodus, but nothing else can be substantiated about this particular king. So I'm going to rule out, as following Corville's example, I'm going to rule out the 18th and the 19th dynasties. The intermediate period, we do not see the strong, stable dynasty spoken of in the Bible. Neither of the intermediate periods becomes a candidate for that, and they will be ruled out too. Then we look at the end of the Old Kingdom and the end of the Middle Kingdom. And in fact, there was an eclipse of power at the end of both of these. Now, you look at the record, and several things emerge. There is a famine inscription, which can be datable to the 12th dynasty. In fact, there are two famine inscriptions which can be datable to the 12th dynasty. There it is, end of the Middle Kingdom. One here, a famine inscription appears in the tomb of Amenai, an official during the reign of Sesostris I, which reads, "No child of the poor did I afflict, no widow did I oppress, no landowner did I displace." And it goes on, "For I had tilled the land all the years, plenty, up to the southern and northern frontiers. Thus I prolonged the life of its inhabitants and preserved the food which it produced. No hungry man was in it. I distributed equally to the widow as to the married woman. I did not prefer the great to the humble in all that I gave away." And also dated contemporary with a king, Sesostris I of the 12th dynasty, is an inscription that has been argued over for some time, which says, "I collected corn as a friend of the harvest god. I was watchful at the time of sowing, and when the famine arose, lasting many years, I distributed corn to the city each year of the famine." Clearly famines of a plurality of years, and they have been argued over for some time, but the evidence can be quite strong that they can be dated to the 12th dynasty under particularly the reign of a gentleman called Sesostris I, the second king of the 12th dynasty. That particular king had a prime minister or a vizier by the name of Mentuhotep. Mentuhotep was the most powerful prime minister that Egypt ever knew. The list of his titles in the secular record, which is worth comparing with the biblical record, which is very similar, reads as follows. He was vizier, he was chief judge, he was overseer of the double granary, he was chief treasurer, he was governor of the royal castle, wearer of the royal seal, chief of all the works of the king, hereditary prince, pilot of the people, giver of goods, sustaining alive the people, count, sole companion, favourite of the king. That's the secular record of this man, Mentuhotep. And the implication is that he was involved in heavy agricultural works. And as someone has commented, in a word, our Mentuhotep, who was also invested with several priestly dignities and was Pharaoh's treasurer, appears as the alter ego of the king. Quote, "When he arrived, the great personages bowed down before him at the outer court of the royal palace. Not before him nor after him has there ever arisen a man of such power who is virtually in the place of the king," of the Pharaoh. It was a powerful dynasty, a strong dynasty, a northern dynasty. It had records of famine under the reign of Sesostris I. Now Corville suggests, in fact implies, that Mentuhotep and Joseph are one and the same persons. When the 13th dynasty is looked at, and the princes of that are looked at, the early princes which can be correlated with the early part of the 12th dynasty, there is a name that emerges in the record called Alphni, and by the normal process of transliteration, the word is equivalent to the word Joseph. In Egypt today, there is also a canal which drains the waters of the Nile into a very large basin, which would be ideal for adding extra water to irrigation. the canal is to this day called the Canal of Joseph, and legend records that it goes back to the Joseph of the Bible. Let's have a look at the 12th dynasty. And some very interesting facts emerge. Firstly, that it rained for about 213 years, which was not far out of line with the period that Israel was in Egypt. The first king was Amenemhet I. That name and Sesostris are the two alternate names found in this dynasty. There's Amenemhet I, Sesostris I, Amenemhet II, whose name was Ramesses. Sesostris II, whose name was Ramesomenes in the Greek. Sesostris III, whose name was Ramesesos. Amenemhet the third, whose name was Ramesomino. And then a very short reign, which appears to be not a full reign but a co-regency, of a gentleman called Amenemhet IV. And then suddenly he is no longer there, and a woman, an old woman called Sebeknafruri, reigns in his place. And then the dynasty comes to an end, and then it appears that the 13th dynasty princes take over for a period of 34 years ultimately, and then Egypt goes into eclipse. If you have a look at the history of these people, Sesostris I can be identified as the Pharaoh of Joseph. In his years there was a famine with a plurality of years and a very powerful vizier who fits all the qualifications of Joseph. There was a period somewhat in excess of 80 years in which there was a benevolent rule by the same family of Sesostris I, and then there appears a king that is not of the same family, Sesostris III, who rises, has a very great building program of the type of material described in the Bible in the northern delta area, builds many cities, and one of them is called Ramesses. It's later altered by Ramesses II of the 18th dynasty, who loved to inscribe his own name everywhere. Sesostris III is almost certainly, he and his son Amenemhet III can be identified as the kings that arose, the king that arose that knew not Joseph. At the end of Amenemhet III's reign is the short reign of a gentleman called Amenemhet IV, who disappears at an equivalent time that Moses disappears from Egypt. And the suggestion has been made that in fact Amenemhet IV, who only reigned as a co-regent, was in fact Moses, who fled from the land of Egypt after killing an Egyptian and incurring the wrath of the Pharaoh. He had to be a high official to incur such wrath and come to such knowledge of the Pharaoh. Then a woman who tradition associates with Moses and her husband associates with Moses, called Sebeknafruri, reigned for a very short period, and finally the dynasty came to an end. Corville suggests that this woman herself is Pharaoh's daughter who adopted Moses. 34 years later, after the reign of two kings, Egypt goes into its second intermediate period. Corville, through a process that I cannot enter into because of time, but it's worth getting hold of his books, The Exodus Problem and Its Ramifications, discusses this fact and also suggests that the first intermediate period in Egypt and the second intermediate period are in fact one and the same period. The Old Kingdom and the Middle Kingdom ruled concurrently, north and south, in a complicated way. At the end of the 13th dynasty, we find the name of a man called Ka-Enkra. Ka-Enkra, who in the Greek is called Concharis. He cannot be found. He reigned briefly, and at the end of his reign, Egypt went into political eclipse and a people called the Hyksos took over Egypt. Concharis, Corville believes, with a lot of evidence behind his argument, Concharis is in fact the Pharaoh of the Exodus who perished in the Red Sea and not Ramesses II of the 18th dynasty many years later. Now, after Concharis left the throne, Egypt went into an eclipse, and a people called the Hyksos invaded Egypt for a period of 400 years. They ruled over Egypt. They were vandals. They wrecked monuments. They destroyed the civilization. Eventually, after 400 years, Ahmose the first of the 18th dynasty drove them out of Egypt, and the mighty 18th dynasty then rose from Egypt, and the great Egyptian empire arose. It's interesting that 400 years is the period in the Bible that is necessary for the eclipse and the rise again of Egypt. At the same time, there is a group of peoples that are seen at the end and the beginning of that period, known as the Amalekites. The Amalekites lived in northern Sinai, from which the Hyksos had to come. The Arabians identify the Hyksos as coming from northern Sinai. It's interesting that they were the first people that met Israel and attacked Israel. They were a vandal group. They were a warlike tribe. They marched, almost certainly, they marched into Egypt and took over a totally destroyed nation and ruled for a period of 400 years. At the end of that period, they were driven out. It's exactly at that period that King Saul is told and commissioned by God to go south into the northern Sinai and to attack and destroy the Amalekites, the same time as the Hyksos are being driven out of Egypt. Hatshepsut of the 18th dynasty calls the Hyksos the Amu, which could well suggest that it was in fact the Amalekites. Velikovsky identifies them as the Amalekites. Corwell insists they're the Amalekites. But all other record has been erased from the face of the earth, as God promised of the Amalekites that he would destroy their name from under heaven. Now, if that's the case, and if the 12th dynasty is in fact the dynasty of the period of the sojourn of Israel in Egypt, then we have to radically revise the whole of the Egyptian chronology, because 1445 BC is placed in the accepted chronology in the 18th dynasty up here. Corwell insists 1445 must be down here at the end of the 13th dynasty, a difference of at least 600 years on the accepted chronology. But this is the only period that fits the biblical description, and in fact it fits it excellently. If that's the case, then there is something drastically wrong with the accepted chronology of Egypt, and in fact with the accepted chronology of the whole of the ancient world, because if you adjust the Egyptian chronology, you must also adjust the chronology of the whole of the ancient world, including Greece. It's interesting to note in Corwell's second book he discusses Greece and a 300-year period that has confused the archaeologists for many years is immediately eliminated as not occurring, and immediately solves one of the great problems of Greek chronology. Several of the others of Mesopotamian origin are solved as well. But this is how the revised chronology should look. The first and the third dynasties concurrent. The second, the fourth and the fifth concurrent. An overlapping of those, the end of those with the sixth, the 11th, the 12th and the 13th, and then finally an eclipse, which is equivalent to the first and the second first and the second intermediate periods of Egyptian history, which we call the Hyksos period. After that, the mighty Egyptian empire, and then another period of confusion at the end of that empire, where you get a number of dynasties ruling in different places in Egypt concurrently. That being the case, worked on the secular record, revised, the date of the founding of Egypt's first dynasty was 2150 BC. You'll see that that is a very good figure as far as the biblical record is concerned. It fits excellently. Now, I can't discuss at all the details of this, but it's worth it. If you want to follow it up, look at Corwell's book. He's got all the arguments. He's obviously spent a long period of time, in fact about 15 years, poring over the documents to try and discern the details. But the situation that comes is that finally the Egypt rose at 2150 BC, the Exodus was at 1445 BC, and the great 18th dynasty arose approximately 1020 BC in the days of Saul. Now, there are many Egyptian pharaohs mentioned in the scriptures. And I'll just conclude with this. It's in the notes. It's a summary of all the occurrences in the Bible of the kings of Egypt. His first means, the one who founded the first Egyptian dynasty, many would equate him with Mizraim. I can't give a conclusion of that. Pharaoh Khufu, or Pharaoh Cheops, the builder of the Great Pyramid, was almost certainly the pharaoh that Abraham met. Sesostris I of the 12th dynasty was the pharaoh of Joseph, and Mentuhotep was in fact Joseph. Sesostris III, Amenhotep III of the same dynasty were the pharaohs of Exodus that oppressed Israel. Sebeknapruri of the 12th dynasty, Moses' foster mother, and possibly Amenhotep IV, Moses himself. Ka'ankra or Conchares was the pharaoh of the Exodus who perished in the Red Sea. Then we find that Egyptian power is not mentioned except in remembrance in the Bible. And finally, we get again Egypt rising in the days of Saul, David, and Solomon. Solomon made alliance. He obviously considered the pharaoh of his day to be powerful enough to make a marriage alliance with him. He married Pharaoh's daughter.